Hey there, Up First listeners. We have a special report for you. Day after day, this podcast brings you the news you need to make sense of the day ahead. Today, we bring you facts you need to make sense of the news on many days ahead. We're covering the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. The House is questioning the president's effort to have Democrats investigated in Ukraine. The information we present in this episode is largely in the open, on the record. There's a lot of dispute over what the facts mean, but little dispute over what the facts are. So what follows is a special report from NPR News. We tell the story of impeachment, the narrative. We work from documents, on-the-record interviews, written testimony. Stay with us, and we will guide you through the story behind the news.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google. From Connecticut to California, from Mississippi to Minnesota, millions of American businesses are using Google tools to grow online. Learn more at google.com/grow.
This is a special report from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep with a story that begins with a document, the United States Constitution, which is inside the building I'm looking at now, the National Archives. There are four faded pages in there. Susan Davis, our congressional correspondent, has been looking at those pages with me. And Sue, what are the passages on impeachment?
The founders, in some ways, were frustratingly vague on this question. It states simply, the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment.
Impeachment, which is a word we don't use a lot, so I looked it up in the dictionary. Impeach means call into question or charge with misconduct.
Yes, and I often describe it as a recommendation. When the House impeaches an individual, they send a recommendation to the U.S. Senate to remove that individual from office.
And then there's a trial according to the Constitution. And what does the document say can get an official impeached and removed?
Again, quote, the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And the question facing lawmakers today is whether President Trump's acts towards Ukraine count as those high crimes and misdemeanors.
Okay, so what are those acts? That is what we're exploring this hour. Investigation has revealed broad agreement about the essential facts of the president's efforts. The big disagreement is over what the facts mean. But we can tell a story of what's known. Putting that story in order helps us to understand it. And in assembling that narrative, which is what we're doing this hour, we are relying on the documents, what's already public, already on the record, like the Constitution we were looking at, official papers, notes of phone calls, text messages, written testimony, and interviews with the people involved. Here at NPR News, a large team has been reporting in depth on the key characters in this story, and our narrative begins with a leading character, the President of the United States.
Mr. President, thank you so much for
taking
time. No, thank you. Busy day.
What was the president thinking about Ukraine over the past few years? He recently said this to Sean Hannity of Fox.
We have an obligation to investigate corruption.
Faithfully
and that's
execute.
What it was. In my opinion, that's what it was, is corruption.
Sounds reasonable, but the president was very specific about what he meant by corruption. He wanted Ukraine to investigate conspiracy theories in which he had a personal interest, discredited theories about the 2016 presidential election. He wanted to know about a computer server hacked by Russia, a hacking he's notably reluctant to blame on Russia.
There was a server, the DNC server, that never went to the FBI. The FBI didn't take it. It was taken by somebody that I guess it's CrowdStrike.
The president wanted to pursue another discredited theory of a former British intelligence agent who gathered allegations linking the Trump campaign to Russia.
I heard Clinton was involved. I heard they got somebody who wrote the fake dossier. Was it out of Ukraine?
Our correspondent Ryan Lucas is here. And Ryan, what is the overall idea that the president was pursuing?
So at root, what all of these conspiracy theories that he has been pushing do is they reject the idea that Russia interfered in the 2016 election by hacking Democratic emails and other means. And instead, what the president is suggesting is that, in fact, Russia wasn't involved. Rather, it was Ukraine working in cahoots with Democrats to undermine Trump. That's the theory that he's pushing.
Okay, no evidence supports that, but that's what he's interested in. What else did the president want?
Well, there was another request that the president made, and that was in a July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president. And what he asked is for Ukraine to investigate former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden, who was the Obama administration's point person on Ukraine. And Biden, of course, is now someone who is running to be the Democratic nominee and challenge Trump for the presidency.
So he wanted a political rival investigated, and the president had help from a man who is the next character in our story.
America's mayor. He's the mayor of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, Rudy Giuliani.
Rudolph Giuliani was introduced there by Oprah back when he was acclaimed for his leadership after the terror attacks on September 11, 2001. Giuliani went on to become the president's personal lawyer, and he recently told Chris Cuomo of CNN what he'd been up to.
I asked the Ukraine to investigate the allegations that there was interference in the election of 2016 by the Ukrainians for the benefit of Hillary Clinton, for which there already is a court finding.
You never asked anything about Hunter Biden. You never asked anything about Joe Biden.
The only thing I asked about Joe Biden is to get to the bottom of how it was that Lutsenko, who was appointed,
right,
dismissed the case against Antac.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
Now, Ryan, when Giuliani says he did and didn't go after Joe Biden, it sounds confusing, but I think it's meaningful because he seems to be saying what other defenders of the president have said. In effect, sure, he went after Biden, but for perfectly legitimate reasons.
That's right. Giuliani doesn't deny going after Biden. In fact, he's told me that he's proud of the work that he's done in Ukraine trying to dig up information on the former vice president. And Biden, of course, was involved in Ukraine in his role in the Obama administration. And yes, Biden's son, Hunter, did join the board of a Ukrainian energy company.
Well, here's another question. If you're the president of the United States, why would Rudy Giuliani be the person to get you information out of Ukraine?
What would a former mayor of New York City know about Ukraine? Fair question. The answer is Giuliani has done a lot of high-priced security consulting work in the U.S. as well as for clients abroad, including in Ukraine. Two of those clients helped with this investigation. Their names are Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. Those are not names that we knew generally, but they have become more familiar to us recently, particularly when they were recently indicted on alleged campaign finance violations.
Trying to build up their influence with the U.S. government. Well, let's dwell on those two businessmen for a moment as we introduce the characters who helped the president pursue his goals, because NPR's Ari Shapiro spoke with a man who had dealings with the two, a man named Dale Perry.
Dale Perry knows about corruption and the energy industry in Ukraine, because he owns an American energy company that does business there. He first heard of Parnas and Fruman when those guys met with Perry's former business partner and presented an unusual plan.
What was so troubling was it was basically the presentation of the intent to take the gas sector back to where it was during the Yanukovych regime.
So a place that would be a little more corrupt, a little less transparent.
A heck of a lot more corrupt.
One part of the plan Parnas and Fruman described at this meeting was to replace the head of Ukraine's state-run gas company. Another part was to replace the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch.
I had never seen anybody in any part of the world where I've worked, and I've worked in some 30 different countries, never seen a business person that claimed that they could see an ambassador removed.
The lawyer for Parnas and Fruman, John Dowd, declined to speak with us for this story. But we can do better than that. Meet one of the men at the center of the indictment.
Lev Parnas, the CEO of a company called Global Energy Producers.
He calls it an energy company. It had no visible business or financing or connections to the energy industry. What it did have was a well-connected ally.
Mayor Giuliani is a very dear friend of mine, yes.
Mayor Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer.
We actually met with the mayor on a business transaction by a company that I owned back in the days. And we just became good friends and just started spending a lot of time together.
The name of that business?
It was a company called Fraud Guarantee.
Fraud Guarantee. Giuliani told Reuters that Fraud Guarantee paid him $500,000 for consulting and legal advice. And Parnas says he and Giuliani also worked closely in Ukraine.
I just happened to be Ukrainian. I happened to speak the language. I happened to also have a lot of resources in that part of the world.
Parnas arranged and sat in on meetings between Giuliani and Ukrainians promising dirt on Democrats.
So, as Ari Shapiro reports, these two businessmen were helping the president's lawyer. President Trump also wanted action, so let's introduce another character, one of the diplomats who pursued his goals.
You're the U.S. ambassador to the EU, but you've been spending a great deal of time in Kyiv. Why is that?
Well, President Trump has not only honored me with the job of being the U.S. ambassador to the EU, but he's also given me other special assignments.
Gordon Sondland spoke of his special assignments on Ukrainian TV.
We have what are called the Three Amigos, and the Three Amigos are Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and myself. And we've been tasked with sort of overseeing the Ukraine-U.S. relationship.
Those Three Amigos, Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, U.S. diplomat Kurt Volker, and Sondland. Sondland is a political appointee named after contributing to the president's campaign. Our colleague Rachel Martin explored his past.
Transactional was a word I heard a lot when asking friends and former colleagues about Gordon Sondland. So was pragmatic. As a hotel developer tight in GOP circles, working in liberal Portland, Oregon, Sondland had to figure out how to work with a lot of people he didn't agree with.
I collect books and wine bottles, and Gordon, among other things, collects relationships.
This is David Nierenberg. He got to know Sondland when they both worked as fundraisers for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign back in 2012. He and others said that back then, it was pretty clear Sondland wanted to hitch his wagon to a candidate who could make him an ambassador, preferably to a German-speaking country. Sondland's Jewish parents fled Germany during World War II. They ended up in Washington State and opened a dry cleaning business. It's a story Sondland has recently started telling a lot.
But I'm the first in my family that was born in the U.S. My parents were both European immigrants. I started in the commercial real estate
business. Nazi Germany. That was the beginning of the uprising of Hitler.
The U.S. Yeah, my mother was able to escape.
David Nierenberg told me Sondland saw an ambassadorship as a way to square the circle of his family's legacy, as some kind of symbolic justice.
It's not uncommon among the people I know who've come through this experience to want to have relationships to powerful people in government. Because, let's face it, almost anyone who either personally survived or whose parents or grandparents survived the Holocaust did so because of the intervention of someone who helped them.
And you think that explains Gordon Sondland's support of President Trump?
I think it may. I think it may.
Len Bergstein spent a decade working as a consultant for Sondland.
Would you describe him as someone who has a strong moral compass or a clearly defined code of ethics?
I've been thinking about that, and I'm not sure I'm able to kind of answer that. He certainly never asked me to go over any lines. He was someone who wasn't looking to kind of bend the rules necessarily, but was trying to bend the narrative, trying to make sure that if he could tell his story in his way, he would win.
That's what a former associate told Rachel Martin about Gordon Sondland. So he became an ambassador, became one of the Three Amigos with authority over Ukraine policy. And Ryan Lucas, did he know about the investigations that President Trump wanted in Ukraine?
He did indeed. And we know that because Sondland acknowledges much in his written testimony to lawmakers. But he says he didn't know everything. And there are other witnesses who have testified that Sondland absolutely knew and actually talked about Biden investigations in a White House meeting in July.
Okay, thanks, Ryan Lucas. Stay with us. We have laid out so far what the president wanted in Ukraine, and we have met some of the people who helped him to seek it. Here's another part of the story. As he sought investigations, the president was also ordering the withholding of military aid to Ukraine. A federal government whistleblower has connected those two acts. So, after the break, let's continue following the facts. How far did the president and his allies go to get what they wanted? This is special coverage from NPR News.
In 1987, dozens of federal agents surrounded a trailer park in Ozark, Missouri. Their target, a white supremacist threatening violent revolution.
I have eight teams of freedom fighters prepared to start a race war nationwide.
The agents fired tear gas, arrested him, and found a massive arsenal.
C4 plastic explosives, hand grenades, thousands of rounds of ammunition.
So, years later, why did the FBI stop watching him? That story on Embedded from NPR.
This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. We're telling the story of the House impeachment inquiry. We're sticking with verified facts, documents, and the participants' own words. And we're assembling a narrative, telling the story in order so it makes sense. What happened? What happened next? And why? This story was first exposed by an anonymous government whistleblower, but by now many facts are open and on the record. So far, we've heard President Trump say why he was interested in Ukraine.
We have an obligation to investigate corruption.
Faithfully
and that's
execute.
What it was. In my opinion, that's what it was, is corruption.
We also heard him define investigating corruption in a narrow and specific way. He wanted to pursue political conspiracy theories about Democrats in the 2016 election. He also said he wanted an investigation of his political rival, Joe Biden. The president's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, said on TV that this was perfectly legitimate.
So you did ask Ukraine to look into Joe Biden?
Of course I did.
You just said you didn't.
We have so far in this program met businessmen and diplomats who were recruited to help the president achieve his goals. By the early part of 2019, which is where we're at in this story, they'd been working for some time, so let's continue the narrative in this part of the program. What happened next? How far did the president and his allies go? These are questions for investigators working near the spot where I'm now standing with our congressional correspondent, Susan Davis. And Sue, where are we here?
We are three floors below the U.S. Capitol, outside a facility that is known as a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility.
Okay.
It is the kind of room on Capitol Hill where lawmakers go when they are hearing classified information. It also gives lawmakers a little bit of privacy and a little bit of control over the media as they take part in this investigation.
And you mentioned the media. We're standing amid a bunch of reporters who are here to watch witnesses come and go. And what is it that investigators think they need to know from those witnesses?
Much of the key facts of the case are not in dispute. The July 25th phone call, the decision to withhold military aid for Ukraine. What Congress and what Democrats specifically are trying to establish is a timeline of events and whether President Trump and his administration took actions that were aimed to serve his own political personal goals over the national security of the country.
And our next character that we will meet as we go through this narrative is someone who has walked through these wooden doors on the way to testify not long ago. Her name is Marie-Louise Yovanovitch. In the spring of 2019, she was a career U.S. diplomat with long experience in Ukraine who was the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. When she was confirmed to that post, she vowed to counter the threat of Ukraine's neighbor, Russia, and said she wanted to bolster Ukraine's democratic institutions. Let's hear a little bit.
Building capacity within the journalistic community, within civil society, so that they themselves can get their own good news out, and they themselves can counter Russian propaganda efforts.
Ambassador Yovanovitch also focused on fighting corruption. So how did she become a target for President Trump, who said he wanted to fight corruption in Ukraine? We reconstructed the ambassador's story with help from Daria Kolenyuk, a Ukrainian anti-corruption activist.
Basically, Ambassador Yovanovitch was a friend for civil society activists in Ukraine. And this is what Yuri Lutsenko and other corrupt officials in power did not like.
Yuri Lutsenko was Ukraine's prosecutor general and a vital figure in what happened next. Civil society groups called him corrupt. They recently summarized their accusations in a formal complaint. They sent the U.S. Treasury Department that complaint, which NPR has obtained. Lutsenko is accused of enriching himself and targeting anti-corruption investigators. This made him just the sort of official the U.S. ambassador called out.
Hi, everybody. Natalia, thank you. And it's really an honor and a pleasure to be here to celebrate.
This is a speech the ambassador gave on March 5, 2019, before a group called the Ukraine Crisis Media Center. She said Ukraine's government was backsliding in its efforts against corruption.
It is increasingly clear that Ukraine's once-in-a-generation opportunity for change has not yet resulted in the anti-corruption or rule of law reforms that Ukrainians expect or deserve.
Soon after this speech, that Ukrainian prosecutor struck back. Yuri Lutsenko suggested the U.S. ambassador was really the corrupt one.
I had some difficult personal relationship with the Miss Ambassador.
On March 20, 2019, Lutsenko gave this interview through an interpreter to Hill TV, a right-leaning website in the U.S.
Miss Ambassador gave me a list of people whom we should not prosecute.
Should not prosecute? Brian Bonner of a Ukrainian newspaper called the Kiev Post says Lutsenko was suggesting the ambassador was protecting someone.
And it turned out to be false, completely false. The State Department denied it and Lutsenko retracted it.
But by then, the toxic claim had spread. The very night of the Hill TV report, another accusation against the ambassador reached a TV program very popular with the President of the United States. Sean Hannity of Fox News interviewed a lawyer linked to the president. On this primetime show, Joe DiGenova suddenly denounced the previously obscure ambassador.
And we also now know that the current United States ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, has badmouthed the president of the United States to Ukrainian officials.
We asked DiGenova where he got that information, and he declined to say. On March 24, Donald Trump Jr. attacked the ambassador on Twitter. And in April, Hannity interviewed the president himself.
Let me start with this issue of the Ukraine.
Hannity asked the president if he'd followed conservative media reporting on Ukraine. The president was vague, but said the story should win a Pulitzer Prize.
These are the ones that should be winning. It sounds like big stuff. It sounds like very interesting with Ukraine.
Weeks later, in the spring of 2019, Ambassador Yovanovitch was called home from her job before the end of her assignment. Now, why would these toxic claims go so directly from Ukraine to people around the president? Here's at least part of the answer. Ukrainians who opposed her were also sources for the president's personal lawyer. Rudy Giuliani was on a months-long search for political dirt in Ukraine to help President Trump. The two indicted businessmen, they were helping Giuliani find information. That prosecutor, accused of corruption, he met Giuliani at least twice. That's according to the report filed by a U.S. government whistleblower. The president's lawyer developed a negative view of the U.S. ambassador. He later claimed on CNN that she stopped him from interviewing witnesses.
They were trying to get to us, but they were being blocked by the ambassador, who was an Obama appointee in Ukraine.
So the ambassador lost her job. According to testimony before House impeachment investigators, her State Department boss told Marie Yovanovitch that she was removed due to the smear campaign, and that she had done nothing wrong. Now, as the ambassador left Ukraine, U.S. policy there was passing to other people. As we've heard, the regular U.S. diplomats were overshadowed by that group called the Three Amigos, three officials conducting an alternative foreign policy. Two were diplomats, and the third amigo is Secretary of Energy Rick Perry, who arrives on stage by the spring of 2019. Exactly how did Ukraine become the Secretary of Energy's responsibility? Well, our colleague Melissa Block has been asking.
Back before he was Energy Secretary, before he attempted to cha-cha his way through Dancing with the Stars, God bless Texas. Before Rick Perry ran for president twice and in a debate famously couldn't remember the federal departments he had promised to eliminate.
I would do away with the education, commerce, and let's see, I can't, the third, sorry, oops.
And you can't make this up, that last department Perry wanted to axe but couldn't remember, it was the Energy Department, which he now heads. Anyway, before all of that, Rick Perry rose to become the longest-serving governor of Texas.
I'm a Texas governor, former governor, and I know how to sell stuff. And my job is to go sell, first off, American product.
That's the Perry trademark, says Scott Braddock of the Quorum Report.
He was always real good at selling Texas. Governor Perry's slogan was, Texas is open for business. And I think that he wanted to bring that to the national stage and to the international stage, that we're open for business.
Specifically, the business of liquefied natural gas, or, as Rick Perry's energy department has dubbed it, freedom gas. It's a growing U.S. export, and Ukraine is a potentially huge market. Historically, Ukraine has depended heavily on natural gas from Russia. So if the U.S. could replace Russian gas with U.S. gas, that would be a big win for American companies and for U.S. foreign policy. Ukraine is a critical counterweight to Russian influence in the region. But Ukraine has also been notorious for corruption, especially in the energy sector, and that has stifled Western investment. So for years, U.S. administrations have pressed Ukraine to root out corruption. It was in this context that Rick Perry headed to the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, in May of this year. He was leading the U.S. delegation to the inauguration of the newly elected president, Volodymyr Zelensky. According to the whistleblower's complaint, Vice President Mike Pence was supposed to head that delegation, but President Trump instructed Pence to cancel his trip, and Perry went in his place. Also with Perry were the other members of the trio who called themselves the Three Amigos. Within days of leaving Kiev, those Three Amigos were back in the Oval Office meeting with President Trump.
They told him Zelensky was a reformer and they wanted Trump to call him. Rick Perry was asked about this on his visit to Lithuania.
Absolutely. I asked the president multiple times, Mr. President, we think it is in the United States and in Ukraine's best interest that you and the president of Ukraine have conversations, that you discuss the options that are there. So absolutely, yes.
But Trump wasn't having it. Here's how Rick Perry described what happened next in an interview on the podcast The Journal, which is produced by Gimlet and The Wall Street Journal.
The president's like, you know, until I'm comfortable that these guys have straightened up their act. And so what did straighten up their act mean? And the president said, visit with Rudy.
Rudy Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, who had been on a crusade for months, alleging that Ukraine colluded with Democrats in the 2016 election. So, as Rick Perry told Wall Street Journal reporter Tim Pucco, he did what Trump told him to do. He called Giuliani.
And I called, and we had never had a conversation before. I called Mayor Giuliani and said, okay, tell me what's going on here. We're trying to get these folks in to meet so that we can move forward with some good economic development, sell them gas. And the president just ain't interested in talking. And as I recall the conversation, he said, look, the president is really concerned that there are people in Ukraine that tried to beat him during his presidential election. He thinks they're corrupt.
As Perry recounted that phone call, Giuliani insisted that it was Ukraine, not Russia, that interfered in the 2016 election and that it did so to hurt Trump. That's a conspiracy theory that has been debunked. One thing that was not mentioned, Perry told the Wall Street Journal, the name Biden.
Never, not in one conversation, not from the president, not from Gordon Sondland, not from Kurt Volker, not from anybody on the Zelensky team, did I ever hear the name Biden. Never, not once.
And remember, that's at the heart of the impeachment inquiry.
That's our colleague Melissa Block. NPR's Ryan Lucas is still listening in. And Ryan, Rick Perry says the president never mentioned Joe Biden to him, but was Biden on the minds of the other two of the three amigos?
Absolutely he was. And we know that because there's testimony that Biden and his son Hunter were very much on the mind, at least of the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, at a meeting at the White House in early July. That is according to the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, who's the top Ukraine expert on the National Security Council.
And I guess there's also no doubt that the president of the United States was interested in Joe Biden.
Exactly, because he mentioned Biden in that July 25th phone call with Ukraine's president.
Well, let's remember that we are telling this story through documents and through people's own words. And, of course, the president's words are in a document, the famous record of the phone call that the White House released. So let's read aloud some of the key quotes here. And Ryan, if you don't mind, I'm going to say words from the Ukrainian President Zelensky, and you can say the words of President Trump. Zelensky, at the point where we'll pick up this phone call, Zelensky asks about buying U.S. weapons. Then what does President Trump say?
President Trump says, quote, I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it. I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike. I guess you have one of your wealthy people. The server, they say Ukraine has it.
The server, that's a reference to those conspiracy theories we've talked about relating to Democrats and hacking in the 2016 election, right?
That is correct, yes.
Now, a bit later, President Zelensky mentions Rudy Giuliani. Here's the quote. I will personally tell you that one of my assistants spoke with Mr. Giuliani just recently, and we are hoping very much that Mr. Giuliani will be able to travel to Ukraine, and we will meet once he comes to Ukraine.
And then a little bit later in the call, Trump replies, quote, good, because I heard you had a prosecutor who was very good and he was shut down, and that's really unfair. A lot of people are talking about that, the way they shut your very good prosecutor down and you had some very bad people involved. Mr. Giuliani is a highly respected man. He was the mayor of New York City, a great mayor, and I would like him to call you. I will ask him to call you along with the attorney general.
Ryan, what all is going on in that part of the phone call?
Well, the president's a bit vague here, but what he may be referring to is a prosecutor, the top prosecutor in Ukraine, who Joe Biden, when he was vice president of the United States, helped push out of office because this prosecutor was perceived as being ineffective in the fight against corruption. The allegation that President Trump has made, an unproven allegation, is that Biden helped get rid of this prosecutor in order to protect his son Hunter, who was on the board of a Ukrainian energy company that had been under investigation.
I see, looking at this record of the phone call, that President Trump is about to mention that. What are the next words from President Trump here?
So what the president says is, quote, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me.
So this is what the president wanted in his own words from that July 25 phone call. But we have been mentioning another thing that the president was doing at the same time, Ryan Lucas, withholding military aid from Ukraine. Where does that fit in here?
So the president ordered around $400 million in military aid to Ukraine suspended. That much is publicly known. Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who we've talked about, denied in a text message that there was any sort of quid pro quo here of military aid in exchange for investigations into 2016 conspiracy theories and the Bidens. But Sondland has kind of stepped back from that, testifying that he was just repeating what the president said. So, yes, we do know the president withheld aid, and we also have words, on the record words, of an official who was deeply involved in this who said that there was a quid pro quo, and that is acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney.
Well, since we're telling the story in the participants' own words, let's hear Mulvaney's words next. And we should set the scene here, I guess. He's standing at the podium at the briefing room in the White House. The room is full of reporters. The television cameras are on. And Mulvaney starts out saying the president withheld aid because he wanted Europeans to do more to help Ukraine themselves. But then he adds another factor. He said the president wanted to pursue that conspiracy theory about a Democratic Party server hacked during the 2016 election.
Did he also mention to me in the past the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money. Now, there was a report.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
Withholding the funding.
Yeah, which ultimately then flowed.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy.
Okay, so that's Mick Mulvaney at the White House.
Now, we have to add here that Mulvaney later tried to walk this back, saying that his words were distorted or misconstrued, but he said into the microphones what we just heard him say.
NPR's Ryan Lucas is with us as we pull together the narrative of impeachment. We started with the president's goals. We have met some of the characters involved as he pressed to meet those goals. And after a short break, who were the people inside the U.S. government who pushed back?
All administrations are tempted to do bad things and have people who have bad instincts or wrong instincts. And then there are people who just have judgment. And I would say that John Bolton comes out of this with a white hat of judgment.
And he is one of the characters we meet when we continue. This is Special Coverage from NPR News. This is Special Coverage from NPR News.
Hey there, it's Tamara Keith. And on the NPR Politics Podcast, we bring you into the conversation with NPR's best political reporters as we talk about the biggest news coming out of Washington and from the campaign trail. New episodes drop every weekday afternoon.
This is Special Coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C., amid the falling leaves of Lafayette Park. There's a tree of brilliant orange over there. There are a lot of yellows over there. This is a public square, most notable for the building that's just over the fences on the south side, the White House. We've come here to continue the narrative that we're laying out in this hour, the narrative of the impeachment inquiry. Susan Davis, our congressional correspondent, is with us. And Sue, how has the White House been responding to that investigation over at the U.S. Capitol?
The White House and the president have not denied the basic facts of the case. Their point is that the president hasn't done anything wrong. They've taken a rather aggressive stance, both publicly, in the words of acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, to get over it, and both to Congress, where the White House's lawyers have said they will not comply with the impeachment investigation.
Which is something that the White House counsel said in a document, a letter to Congress. We're telling the story through documents, through verified facts. And yet we have to note that in spite of that total resistance, that message of total resistance, people keep testifying.
People are testifying. People are appearing under subpoena. The fact is, some officials within the government, including within the White House over there, raised objections about these events even as they were taking place.
Which is something we know through written testimony. One of the people who's been described in that testimony is the next character in our story. John Bolton served until recently as national security advisor with an office over in the White House and a close-up view of the president's efforts. Here's NPR's Mara Liasson.
Back in September, when President Trump fired Bolton with a tweet, Bolton's enemies, and there were plenty of them, described him anonymously, of course, as abrasive, self-promoting, a warmonger, and disloyal. There was also a clash over policy. Bolton wanted a tougher line on Iran, Venezuela, and North Korea. The president disagreed. But now, after testimony about Bolton's role in the battle over Ukraine aid, a more complicated portrait of the national security advisor emerges.
I think the portrait that comes through is exactly the person who he is. He's a very shrewd lawyer. He's very attuned to his own principles. And he doesn't get mixed up in dirty stuff.
That's Danielle Pletka, a foreign policy expert at the American Enterprise Institute, who says in every administration, there are white hats and black hats.
All administrations are tempted to do bad things and have people who have bad instincts or wrong instincts. And then there are people who just have judgment. And I would say that John Bolton comes out of this with a white hat of judgment.
Lawmakers heard from two people who worked with Bolton on Ukraine. They said Bolton was so irritated after he learned about the plan to connect U.S. military assistance to a Ukrainian pledge to investigate the Bidens that he abruptly ended a meeting. He told Fiona Hill, the former NSC official in charge of Russia, that she should, quote, have nothing to do with domestic politics. According to Hill, Bolton also called Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer and shadow emissary to Ukraine, a, quote, hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up. According to William Taylor, the current acting ambassador to Ukraine, Bolton was also opposed to setting up a phone call between the Ukrainian president and Trump because he was worried it would, quote, be a disaster. Bolton, along with other top administration officials, was in favor of getting the congressionally appropriated military aid to Ukraine. After all, it was U.S. policy to help Ukraine defend itself in an ongoing hot war against Russia, a war that had already claimed 13,000 Ukrainian lives.
John gets a lot of bad press, and I think, you know, thank God John was there.
Eric Edelman was Undersecretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration.
There were a lot of people who were, you know, very negative about John. But I think on all the big issues, North Korea, Iran, this Ukraine-Russia stuff, I think by and large, John was on the side of the angels and trying to keep the president from going outside of bounds.
Going outside of bounds on foreign policy, but also potentially outside the bounds of the Constitution.
In Mara Liasson's story of John Bolton, we heard the name of another official, William Taylor, who's another of the characters within government who pushed back against the president's plans. William Taylor was an American pinch hitter in Ukraine. He's been serving as acting ambassador since Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch was recalled. He was on duty during the summer of 2019 when President Trump made his phone call asking for investigations. He remained on duty in September as the president continued withholding military aid. And he wrote text messages saying what he thought. One of his longtime colleagues was the former U.S. diplomat William Burns.
He was very honest about what he saw to be wrong, about the effort to use American political leverage, not in pursuit of our national interests, but rather in pursuit of personal political gain.
So who is Taylor, and what did he say? Here's NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
William Taylor is an Army veteran and a longtime Foreign Service officer who has worked in the Middle East, Afghanistan, and Ukraine.
He was probably my most frequent visitor when I was the ambassador in Kyiv, because he was at that time the coordinator of American assistance to Ukraine.
That's Stephen Pfeiffer, who was ambassador to Ukraine in the late 1990s and a friend and former colleague of Taylor's. He says Taylor's experience working on U.S. aid programs in the newly independent former Soviet Republic made him the right choice to become ambassador there in 2006.
He was popular. I mean, and he did some interesting things. He had served in the U.S. Army, and he'd been parachute qualified, and so once or twice. I don't think he told Washington about this until after the fact, but he jumped out of a helicopter with some Ukrainian paratroopers.
In recent years, Taylor was at the U.S. Institute of Peace, where he recorded many interviews about Ukrainian politics, including this podcast after comedian-turned-politician Volodymyr Zelensky was elected.
The new president, the president-elect, is getting a lot of support from the international community, and as people told me over and over, the Americans are key.
Soon after that interview, the ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was abruptly withdrawn, having faced a smear campaign, and Taylor found himself back in Kyiv as acting ambassador. Many of his friends and colleagues praise him for the role he seems to have played this year, when Trump temporarily delayed military aid, while his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, pressed Ukraine to open investigations into Trump's political rivals. House committees released text messages that show Taylor writing, quote, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." In another, Taylor writes that President Zelensky is sensitive about Ukraine being taken seriously, not merely as an instrument in U.S. re-election politics.
Let's dwell on Michelle Kellerman's last phrase, U.S. re-election politics, because there is a striking detail in William Taylor's testimony before House investigators, a detail suggesting the use that President Trump wanted to make of the investigations he was requesting from Ukraine. NPR's Ryan Lucas is still with us. And Ryan, what was the detail?
So Taylor testified that Trump wanted Zelensky to announce in an interview on CNN that Ukraine's government was investigating Joe Biden.
What is the significance that it would be CNN, an American television network?
Well, it would inject it directly into the bloodstream of the U.S. political world, just as the 2020 presidential campaign is getting into gear, and potentially cripple Joe Biden's candidacy as well.
Okay, thanks. That's NPR's Ryan Lucas, who's been helping us through the narrative of the Ukraine affair. Okay, so the story has now moved forward to September 2019. This is when the president's efforts in Ukraine burst fully into the light. An anonymous whistleblower in the U.S. intelligence community put together much of the information we have learned. The whistleblower reported it to an inspector general. We should note that for the narrative we've laid out during this hour, we are relying very little on that anonymous person's testimony. That's because so much of the information is corroborated. We are relying instead on what's on the record, in documents, or on video. But the whistleblower is who exposed this story. The New York Times has reported it was a CIA officer, and it is known that the whistleblower reported to an inspector general in the intelligence community. It's meaningful that the person comes from the intelligence world because the president has been openly hostile toward U.S. intelligence officials for years. NPR's Mary Louise Kelly has the backstory to the whistleblower's complaint.
I considered a dozen places to dive into this story. I picked this one.
I don't think anybody knows it was Russia that broke into the DNC.
September 26th, 2016, the first presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?
Okay, but by then, candidate Trump was already receiving classified intelligence briefings, and intelligence officials were already privately telling reporters, including me, it was the Kremlin that hacked the servers of the Democratic National Committee. Donald Trump continued to reject this conclusion. And then came November and the election.
Donald Trump wins the presidency of the United States. He is now going to be called president-elect.
By the following January 2017, that president-elect was sitting down for a top-secret briefing.
Tonight, the face-to-face meeting inside Trump Tower.
It's January 6th, exactly 2 weeks before the inauguration. The Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, along with the heads of the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency, had traveled to New York. Their unenviable task? Informing Trump that they were about to hit publish on a report that said Vladimir Putin personally ordered an influence campaign to try to help him win.
He had great difficulty, as did his team, accepting the assertion that the Russians interfered.
General Clapper, when I asked him about it the other day, he said that while he had been apprehensive beforehand, the Trump Tower meeting was actually pretty cordial.
But I do think the end result was reflected in the attempt to draft a press statement while we were still there, in which they wanted to quote us as saying that the Russian interference had no impact on the outcome of the election, which we could not did not say. We weren't chartered to assess that.
I asked Clapper to revisit this now ancient history because it feels worth recalling just how poisoned the well between Trump and the intelligence community was even before Donald Trump was sworn in as President Trump. Because after that, it got worse. General Clapper.
I was heartened by the fact that, as I heard a couple days later, that the first place he was going to visit after the inauguration was CIA. Naive me, I thought, well, perhaps my message got through to him. Not so.
This is my first stop, officially.
His first full day in office after weeks of mocking intelligence officials, the president's motorcade rolled out to CIA headquarters. He told staffers there he was now with them, quote, 1,000%.
Maybe sometimes you haven't gotten the backing that you've wanted, and you're going to get so much backing. Maybe you're going to say, please don't give us so much backing.
So far, so good. But at some point, standing in what the CIA considers sacred space before a wall of stars representing officers who've died in the line of duty, he started saying things that were provably untrue. Things like falsely inflating the size of the crowd at his inauguration.
But we had a massive field of people. You saw that. Packed.
This digression about his crowd size went on for a while. Ask a CIA official to name a low point in relations with this White House, and this is one of two many will point to. Here's the other.
Distinguished Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen.
Helsinki, 2018, the summit with Putin, and the moment when all the bad blood between Trump and his spy chiefs was distilled to a single question from AP reporter Jonathan Lemire.
Just now, President Putin denied having anything to do with the election interference in 2016. Every U.S. intelligence agency has concluded that Russia did. My first question for you, sir, is who do you believe?
I was there, along with journalists from all over the world, packed into Finland's presidential palace, waiting to hear what Trump would say.
They said they think it's Russia. President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be.
I think that is one of the most tragic moments in the history of the relationship between a United States president and the intelligence community.
Leon Panetta, who used to run the CIA. Panetta told me his specific beef is the message Trump's words sent to the rest of the world.
That we were dealing with a president who has no sense of the importance of intelligence and the important role our intelligence people play in protecting the security of our country.
When I heard by the news reports that this whistleblower is apparently a CIA employee, I just thought, my God.
John Rizzo, he spent 34 years as a CIA lawyer.
Do you see an irony in the fact that given that Trump and the relationship with his intelligence leaders has played out as it has since day one, that it's now a CIA whistleblower that appears to be bringing the country to the brink of impeachment?
Well, I guess ironic is one way to put it, Mary Louise. Yes. Yeah, honestly, I almost wish that the whistleblower had been from somewhere else in the government, because as I say, this brings the whole relationship between President Trump and the intelligence community full circle and possibly irretrievable.
A former CIA lawyer who spoke with NPR's Mary Louise Kelly, who brings our narrative of the Ukraine affair up to now. How do we make sense of all this? Well, NPR's Mara Liasson is here in our studios. And Mara, listening again to the president's battles over Russian interference in the 2016 election, I'm struck by how much his interest in, his involvement in Ukraine is about that, about refighting 2016.
Well, half of it is about refighting 2016 and getting revenge against this narrative. It's not just a narrative. It was the conclusions of his intelligence community, the conclusions of the Mueller investigation that Russia interfered in the 2016 election in order to help him. Putting aside whether he knew about it or not, that is what happened. And he is determined to prove that something else happened, that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election on behalf of Hillary Clinton. It's very confusing. If they did interfere, why did they seem to interfere in a way that helped him? Anyway, all of this ends up in a weird way helping Vladimir Putin. That's kind of the backdrop. But the thing that's really driving impeachment is his interest in discrediting a current and prospective political rival, and that's Joe Biden. One of the reasons that Mick Mulvaney got tied up in knots in the briefing room is because he was trying to say, we were asking Ukraine to look into something that was legitimate. The 2016 election is the subject of a current Department of Justice investigation. What Mulvaney was trying to do was to separate that from the other request, which is much more salient to impeachment, which is that the president was asking a foreign country to investigate a current political rival, trying to get a foreign country to intervene in an upcoming election, not to look back.
And of course, we're referring to his own words there in a July 25 phone call. So given all the people who pushed back against the president's efforts, is the president of the United States at war with the government?
Well, he certainly is at war with what you could call fact-based agencies, the intelligence community, the FBI. We've seen him go to war on other completely separate issues with the Federal Reserve, you know, even with scientists in the EPA. And certainly he is now, as these impeachment inquiry proceedings go forward, he's at war with some of his own White House staff, some of his own White House officials who have a different interpretation of the phone call with Zelensky than he did. He calls it a perfect call. But as we hear this testimony, other people thought it was an inappropriate call because they heard him asking the Ukrainian president to do something that would help him in the 2020 election.
Now the House of Representatives is continuing its formal impeachment inquiry. Are we able to say how well U.S. institutions are holding up under this test?
Well, I've said many times that Donald Trump is a stress test on democratic institutions, and I would say they have not collapsed with the weight of that. They're holding up. We're having an impeachment proceeding that, as you just explained, is sanctioned and described in the U.S. Constitution, and that is going forward. You have a White House who initially said they wouldn't cooperate at all. But yet you have White House officials, some of them currently employed in the White House, honoring subpoenas that they've received from Congress. That's, to me, an institution that's holding up.
Other officials have been asking judges for a ruling, which is also part of the system.
Which is also part of the system. So we're not having a constitutional crisis. I think we're having a constitutional clash, a separation of powers battle. But no, so far, I would say the institutions, you know, although, as I said, they're under stress, no, they're holding up.
Mara, thanks very much for your insights.
Thank you.
Mara Liasson is one of many NPR correspondents and producers who have assembled this narrative of the Ukraine affair. We've also heard throughout the hour from NPR's Susan Davis and NPR's Ryan Lucas. This has been special coverage from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. And this has been a special report from Up First from NPR News. Our producers are Gemma Waters and Kelly Wessinger. Our editors are Eric Maripodi and Mathoni Maturi. We've been giving you the narrative, the story that can help make sense of many days of news ahead in the impeachment inquiry. You can stay up to date on that story on the radio on your NPR station and also at npr.org/impeachment.